Well, good afternoon, everybody. I am thrilled to see all of you here. That coveted after lunch spot usually can mean two things. Either you have an incredible panel, which I am very lucky to have, which explains why all of you are here, and I have a feeling we're going to be fending people off at the door, or it's that after lunch lull, which I no longer have to worry about. So I'm very happy to see all of you here because I really count myself extremely lucky to have this formidable panel up here with these two extraordinary women. I thought because Nina, directly to my left, her book has just come out, and so by way of highly commending it to you, I would introduce you to these two books, Juliette's book, and of course she's no stranger to those of us who live in Massachusetts as a former gubernatorial candidate and as somebody we see a lot of on our airwaves trying to explain very complex matters to us. Her book came out in April, so many of you may have picked that up already and will have specific thoughts and questions on that. But I thought I would introduce these two women to you through their books and give you a little bit of a taste of what they have thought about in presenting these two memoirs to us. Through their personal stories, I really felt, and my copies of these books are earmarked and look like they've been taken to town. They really do illuminate through their own personal stories some of the most significant, some of the most challenging questions that we are facing together in terms of where we are as the future of the West, in terms of our security, in terms of defending our freedoms, in terms of what those kind of values are worth to us. But in their own way, and you'll discover this when we get into our conversation, they're very different. They're very different books. So Juliette sat down and meticulously recounts in this book what made her a Homeland Security professional, how she came of age in this area after 9/11, and just how this idea of Homeland Security, these sort of complex interlocking challenges, became to be subsumed under this heading. But she does it in a way that she gives all of us in this room a very personal vantage point on how we can be more resilient, more adaptive, and ultimately more ready for what is to come. And she very elegantly addresses the consequences of choice, not for just for her own life, but the consequences of choice that we make with our political decisions and in our political system. So it's a formidable book, and I recommend it to you. Nina, who had a long career as a U.S. Army intelligence officer, took an approach to take her own story back in 40 Autumns, which is, to me, as someone who was born and raised in Germany, in West Germany, as a mother of an American and with a German father, really, truly a very haunting, a very personal reminder to my generation of German Americans, but to all of us, what it means to live in freedom and what it can mean if you live in a police state that was East Germany, and what that can mean for your family life, what that can mean to be personally oppressed, and what that means when one of your family members, as Nina so beautifully describes in her book, her mother manages to flee from East Germany to the West, and that has severe impacts on the rest of the family that lives and remains in the East. It, of course, has all the emotional components of being separated by an impenetrable wall, and it traces two parallel stories, ultimately, in the next generation between Nina and her cousin Kadula, who becomes a star, an Olympic star, in the GDR's indoor cycling, in the track cycling arena. And so these are parallel lives of women who have had to make difficult choices for themselves and had to, in their own way, become very resilient to the political circumstances in which they found themselves, in part by choice and in part by history. So I thought with these two books, these two security professionals could have taken a very different approach in thinking about writing a book. But they both chose to write a memoir. And so since this is personal as political, I thought maybe we would start right there and have you both reflect on why, with all this information and everything that you've known and seen, why a memoir, Juliet?
Well, thank you. Thank you for that introduction. And thank you all for being here. It's amazing. I only had to travel about a mile and a half from Cambridge, but I'm grateful that many of you are here today. So the decision to write a memoir was not easy for me. And the realization, well, let me go back. I had a story to tell, and it was a story of what our homeland security really was. And it was a way to tell it to the American public and to the public, all of you, that was very different than my apparatus, my, you know, counterterrorism, super squirrely group of people talk to you. And we had sort of, you know, professionalized this capacity to talk to the public in a way that either made them tune out or freak out, right? And those were your only two options. So I thought, well, maybe there's another way to tell this story of what this thing is, Homeland Security, where it's broken, where it can be fixed, and also, most importantly, how we can engage all of you in your own sort of resiliency and preparedness. And so so I knew I had a story to tell, and I didn't know how to tell it. And then I got an email, so I described this in the book, from my cousin Karen. So one of the themes of the book, I'm also from the daughter of Lebanese immigrants, and being an Arab American in this world is unique. And I have a very big Lebanese family, and my cousin Karen sends me an email, and she's also my dentist. And because the Lebanese, you know, they all go into, anyway, I won't, it's, anyway, long story, but we have a lot of dentists in the family. And she writes me an email that subject matter is Al-Qaeda, and I don't know if I know it by heart, but her daughter is going to New York. She's a little bit nervous about it because it's an anniversary of 9/11, and she said, and I'm the terrorism expert in the family. Like, I don't actually do anything helpful, like fix computers or bake or anything, but I actually can answer these questions. And she writes in a way a mother does about her daughter, you know, essentially, would you, you know, she's nervous, and would you send your daughter, right? Because I have three kids. But interspersed in these questions are things like, are you flossing? You know, how are you wearing your, you know, your headgear? And so the last sentence is, don't forget to wear your night guard and let me know about the terrorists. That's her last sentence. But it was a way of illuminating to me. She just wanted me to talk to her like her cousin, her friend, the girlfriend sitting around the table with a cup of coffee. And so the way to do that was write about me as a mother of three, and, you know, sort of, you know, with humor and compassion, hopefully, but also with a sense that the only way we were gonna, I could engage the public in Homeland Security was to maybe sort of just lay it all bare, and the challenges of having those three kids, but in ways that also impacted my mothering. So I describe, you know, I was very critical of the war in Iraq before it started and during. So I was one of the anthrax letter people that wasn't anthrax, thankfully, but, you know, sort of a hoax letter coming and then making the mistake of going home after I could have been exposed, and you know, raising three kids through H1N1. I was in charge of managing the distribution of the vaccine in 2009, and sort of just tell those stories honestly in hopes that maybe this is a book that people will read about, you know, as I say, it's your homeland too.
The structure of Nina's book is very interesting because she takes us first into her own story and her thoughts about her grandmother and not understanding as a little girl why they were so far away and why she couldn't have met them. And only later, much later in the book, do we learn about her own very dangerous career as an Army intelligence officer in West Germany, going into the East and reporting back. And she tells the rest of that story through, she really takes us back to where her personal story started. So, you know, the memoir, I mean, you could have just, quote unquote, gone in at chapter, you know, in the last third of your book,
right,
and written something very rich and interesting about that historical time, and yet you chose that lens.
And I almost did that, but in actuality, what happened was it actually started out as just a family history. So after the wall fell in 1989 and the family came out from behind the Iron Curtain, there was about a 10, 15 year period there where we just allowed them to adapt, to learn, to live in freedom, didn't bother them, questions. And just the family came together and we got together and embraced that time that we had lost for those 40 years. But then they started to tell their stories, and I listened and I asked a lot of questions, and I asked them if I could record the stories just for the family history, for my children, so my children could learn, and we would have a record of that. And they agreed to that, and then the more I heard and the more it came together, I just realized that perhaps this was a narrative nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
This is something, and I still was not part of the equation. And so I asked them, you know, could I follow this and write your story, you know, after my mother left, and then start there. And yeah, they agreed. They thought, in you know, the purposes of history, people should know their story. So they agreed to that. And then I looked at my mother's story closer, and I realized she really had been exposed to a lot of things as well. And then she escaped that as a 20-year-old. And then I considered the fact that as a 22-year-old, my first job, I was asked to go back into East Germany to do intelligence work. So we sort of rounded that out and decided that we had a pretty extraordinary story. And because we brought in a lot more family stories, not only the people in the East, but my story, my mother's story in the West, and my father's story is in there as well. My brother's story, and my brother ends up going into East Germany as an 18-year-old, and that story's in the book as well. So it just became this a memoir. I mean, it really did. It followed the family for the 40 years on both sides of the Iron Curtain and what happened in that time. So then it sort of organically became a memoir, I think.
I think those stories are beautifully illustrative for those of you who think, my goodness, I have a story in me, but I don't know how it's itching to come out, but I don't know how. I think those are two beautiful stories of how that is a process and how listening to yourself and those around you can then tease out something that you potentially never intended to write. So as I was thinking about these two very different stories, they have very strong commonalities, though, despite their differences. And Juliet has a concept that she tries to pass on to all of us, and this is this idea of grip, which is something that, you know, is in some respects counterintuitive. And as I then was reading Nina's book, I thought in the description of her mother's flight, which was attempted numerous times, plotted numerous times, thought about numerous times, because to those of us for whom that history might not be as vivid anymore, the wall didn't get built until many or, you know, a number of years after the war. So that border, though, you know, heavily guarded, had its sort of its porous qualities. And so here this young woman in Hannah thinks about what is worth more, my family, my freedom, my opportunities, and she has a number of family members who say, you've got to go. Her grandfather tries to push her across the border, and then she plots it out numerous times, and there's sort of a mix of intuition and actual plotting about it. And I found that sort of beautifully resonant in this idea of grip. So I thought maybe Juliet could tell us what she means when she thinks that all of us should adapt this idea of grip.
So I guess I should start with the title of the book. Those of you who are political know that this demographic of the security mom, defined after September 11th, was a predominantly white, suburban, college-educated woman. They were mothers and were very instrumental in both the 2002 midterms and 2004 victory of Bush over Kerry. The idea being that these were women that put terrorism and the safety and security of their families first, and then the caricature of them, and they became like, you know, an advertising phenomenon. You know, everyone was, you know, they were the new soccer moms. In fact, ironically, the person who dubbed security mom is Kellyanne Conway, which I won't get. I had the book first before. And the idea of her was pathetic. I describe in the book, you know, she's sort of that Lucille Ball character standing on the table screaming for Desi Arnaz to, you know, kill the mouse or get rid of the mouse. And very, very defenseless, very nervous. Isn't able to assess risk to her family appropriately, right? So these are all the caricatures of her, and I just thought that's like not the woman I know, let alone the security families. I mean, I think going back to Karen, my cousin's email, I mean, they just want to know sort of what should I do? Can you help me out here? And so I sort of wanted to turn the security mom notion on its head and say, look, we all have the capacity to do three fundamental things. If you ask me, what is Homeland Security? I've been in counterterrorism and Homeland Security since 98, so before 2001. It is about minimizing risk, maximizing defenses, and maintaining our spirit as a country, as a community, as a family. And we know that intrinsically, right? Our kids wear helmets, we make them put on seat belts, we talk to them about bad things that could happen, whatever. And then when it comes to sort of Homeland Security, and I don't just talk about terrorism, you know, hurricanes, oil spills, all these things that I had to work, viruses, you know, H1N1, Ebola, Zika, whatever. The world of mayhem, which has been my world, the skills were the same. Right? I mean, they were about trying to reduce those risks and what can you do to prepare yourself. And so I won't get into the how-to aspect. I just want to end with GRIP. So just because everyone's like, what should I do? So read the book. The one thing I will say to this audience is I have worked many disasters of epic tragedy, and I'm a happy person, which is, you know, people are like, you're always so happy. Part of that is you see people's greatness in those moments. In some ways, I wish, you know, you could capture that and apply it to politics and everything else. But the most important thing is family unification. It cuts across every disaster I've ever worked, from Haiti to the Boston Marathon to whatever. If something bad happens, the most important thing to anyone is going to be, where are my kids, where's my, and essentially in this order, how are my kids, how is my partner, how am I, in that order. Sometimes how are my pets, which I, anyway. And so don't worry about the dog will be fine. So just, that's my little, you know, GRIP to you, is just think that through with your partner or your family, just what would happen if there was a moment in which the regular systems get interrupted. That's GRIP. That's empowering. It's not scary. It's actually, you sort of feel better afterwards.
So in Nina's case, her family at some point didn't have that choice so much. Your grandmother insisted after Hannah's flight, and I want you to talk about how Hannah made those decisions using part intuition, part an assessment of risk. But at some point, your grandmother, after Hannah had departed and they tried to get her back for different reasons, decided, well, in this police state which we inhabit, where they will make it so that you cannot trust anybody, including your own family members, because that is one way to make citizens into subjects and control them, ultimately. Your mother's mother, your great-grandmother, decided that the family wall, to Juliet's point, was going to be the most important, ideally impenetrable thing to the state. So I wondered if you could, based on what Juliet said, reflect on how those kind of components played out in your family.
Right. Well, so as you said, my Oma, my grandmother, this was very important to her since my mother was born. So when the Cold War started, she was 17 years old, and she was already very well aware of this. They had a very tight-knit family at the time. They had 6 kids at that time. They had a few more after during the Cold War. So 9 children altogether. But this was the core. You know, this strong family was the is really the core of the story. I mean, it's about that sort of entrenchment of those beliefs that the family sticks together no matter what, you lean on each other. The family wall itself came about, actually started the day the Soviets set foot in Germany and became East Germany. But the family wall actually was a construct after the Berlin Wall was built in 1961. The mother actually gave it a name and said, well, we're going to build our own wall. And this is sort of a bubble around the family. And for all that is going on outside, and when you were told, this was an environment where people were informing on each other for the Stasi, the secret police, and this went through the all 40 years of the Cold War. People were not only encouraged but taught to inform on each other, to tell on each other, and this is how these people lived. For my mother, or for my grandmother, this family wall was incredibly important to keep the family together. Now, my mother was 17, as I said, when the Cold War started, and she was one of the oldest children. And she sensed from the beginning, she was old enough to sense that as a teenager, that that the Russians coming in was not a good thing. Mm-hmm. And of course, they were told, they learned quickly that the Russians were raping women as they were coming in and that sort of thing. So there was an automatic warning flag for my mother and everybody in the East. But what happened was my mother asked the family to leave. Her mother, Oma, would not leave because the father and son were not back from war. She tried again after they came back from war. She asked again, I think we should leave. They didn't want to leave. But after several things had occurred that she had been exposed to, you know, the fact that there was a Soviet order that said you can be shot for eating unauthorized food. You know, she was working in the fields one time and had a carrot. She was so hungry and chose not to eat it for the fear of being shot. You know, it's that kind of thing. So she was exposed to all of those things constantly, and students in her classroom being dragged out for not sitting and watching, you know, video footage of Lenin's funeral, that sort of thing. Never, you know, dragged out and never seen again, that sort of thing. So my mother witnessed this and said, I cannot be part of this. And so I think that decision was always with her. You know, you talk about this instinct, intuition versus calculation. I think it was always in her head. She was always calculating when that time would be. And as you know, from reading the book, it's, you know, she made several attempts and mm-hmm. she was fired on and she knew the risks, but she was willing to take that risk to get out of that environment.
So Julia makes this to me, since I was a little girl, has always seemed counterintuitive, and Juliet leans on that in the book. When you go through, the security little video or whatever it is with your stewardesses on the plane, and they always say, you know, put your mask on first and then put the mask on the child. And Juliet said, yeah, you know, this is the thing about Homeland Security, where we do have to do the intellectual work in addition to the intuition and try to bring those two together, because, as you just so beautifully said, family first, then partner, then maybe yourself. And every security briefing on every flight will tell you, no, actually, yeah. You first, then the others. And you shared a little bit of that anthrax story, which I thought was so vivid, because I'll let Juliet tell it in detail. But she knows exactly how dangerous this is, and yet her first intuition is to go home to her infant child, and how you had to reconcile that. I thought that was an interesting approach. So sometimes intuition is helpful, and the thing that makes you, when the adrenaline is flowing, makes you make that right move, right. And sometimes it's not. And how do you train yourself to know when to read a situation like that?
Right, no, it's and that's the challenge, and what I tell. So I'm very honest in the book about my own mistakes, as well as those of the thing that I am a part of and that have been identified with for so long. And so I don't defend every aspect of the post 9/11 United States, but as you were saying, so one of the things that I try to say is sort of, you know, I have this mantra, which is, you know, don't be scared, get prepared, because I do think if you can just spend some time thinking through things like family unification, home preparedness, communication, planning, you know, cyber protections in your own home, it's actually incredibly liberating. Sometimes it's not intuitive. And so I do tell an early story of a couple of moments in which here I am in counterterrorism. On 9/11, I am on a train to New York City with a 5-week-old. I'm on maternity leave. I am in counterterrorism and had actually decided I was going to take the maternity leave through 2001 and then change careers because it felt like terrorism was not a growth industry. I explained that honestly. And then, of course, you know, my career and probably yours sometimes defined by outside circumstances, right? And so, and the lack of intuition of getting off that train. I knew exactly what it was. And then, you know, sort of feeling like, okay, now I know, as I'm heading towards New Haven, I finally evacuate the train because we had no protocol. So that's sort of my first moment in which I stand on a chair and tell people, get off this freaking train because it's going into New York City. Just a few weeks later, the anthrax attacks start. And because I was an expert, I kind of knew it was not Islamic terrorism, mostly, or Al-Qaeda affiliated, because mostly, you know, they wanted that big moment. Like they saw in 9/11, we knew it. Those of us who knew Al-Qaeda knew that, you know, from the Africa embassy bombings in 98 to the USS Cole, they liked the visual. And anthrax was something different, also new from history, as we certainly saw from arrest last night. Like, the United States has had domestic terrorism for a long time, a lot of people were from, you know, former military or sort of liked anthrax. Anthrax was sort of the thing of choice. So these anthrax letters that were real started to get mailed, and I happened to be on TV and say, look, you know, those of you who remember the 9/11 time, it was, you know, to sort of give a countervailing theory of the case, like I did publicly, was not very acceptable. And so got a lot of, Rush Limbaugh sort of attacked me on air, and then he has a lot of followers, got a lot of emails, and then opened up a letter stupidly. That all this powder came out. And so just to end the story, so I don't do all the protocols I had been trained to, right? I don't close my door, I don't call the right people. I completely freak out, because at this stage, Cecilia's like 10 weeks old, 10 or 11, I walk home and I hold her, right? Because I'm so nervous about, God, if they could find me at the Kennedy School where I was teaching, could they find? And I admit that very openly, I did everything wrong. And thankfully, you know, it wasn't real. But, you know, part of what I say is, you know, sometimes our intuition is off. Like, sometimes you actually have to think through, and that's why I'm into planning about what you should do. Because I went by gut, and sometimes gut isn't right. As the reason why we train you on airplanes, put yours on, is because you won't be helpful to the child if you lose consciousness. So you need to make sure you're conscious through oxygen than others. That's totally unintuitive, right? All of us who have kids would do, I'm going to protect them first. So now you know why we say that on airplanes.
I want to switch gear a little bit to another theme that spoke strongly to me in both of your books, is this theme of roots and why we end up choosing the careers we choose. Both of you have this immigrant background, and your families came to this country eventually and made this your homeland and your home. And I was thinking about sort of the choices we make. Juliet and I have a colleague at the Kennedy School who says, we're not ever really free to make these choices. We have water that we carry for our ancestors, whether that's conscious or not. And both of you found a way. Juliet could have, you know, instead of pushing to be an Arab American, if you will, with that identity of her Lebanese last name on Homeland Security Committees, right, left, and center, and then taking on responsibility for the state of Massachusetts, she could have said, well, I'm going to opt out of that narrative, and I'm going to take my husband's name, because then, you know, nobody will know until maybe they meet me and I create that personal narrative. And in Nina's case, it drew her back, and she has a beautiful component later in the book, very moving, where she is conducting her intelligence operations going into the East, and not very far from her, her cousin is training to be, you know, a model citizen, an Olympic athlete for the German Democratic Republic. And two histories so close and yet so far. So I thought maybe you could reflect on, now that you've written this book and thought this through and thought about that whole narrative of your family, what home means to you and what the choices that now make up home for you, you mean after having done this reflection?
Right. Well, clearly, I come from a family who, this book is about my mother's family. My father happens to be a Holocaust survivor, Auschwitz survivor, so there's a whole nother story there. It's a mention in the book, but so I come from these people who have lived through something and understand the power of freedom and opportunity. So when they came to America, you know, I grew up knowing the stories, understanding the what they had been through, and it became sort of, and family was very central to all of that. It became just very important to me and to all the children in our family, six of us children, that you have to thank the country that gives you opportunity and freedom, and you have to give back. So. My father's story is that after the camps, he ended up enlisting in the U.S. Army to pay back the country that helped save him. And my mother, of course, ended up in America as well, and the land of opportunity, and was able to raise their children in the land of opportunity. And so, I really think that idea about service to country was why I originally went into the Army, and I hope to sort of follow in my father's footsteps, which he was an intelligence officer, and I was able to work in that area as well. And certainly I think my career was also shaped, so I did intelligence for a while in various capacities, and then I went into human rights and humanitarian aid, democracy promoting activities around the world. I've lived most of my life outside the U.S., rule of law activities, that sort of thing. So, yes, all of their experiences and living with parents that come from struggle and, certainly shaped my career. Mm.
I think about this all the time now because, and Juliette has a beautiful mention of a citizenship ceremony that she presided over, and she says very clearly just how difficult, how much courage it takes to leave your original homeland. And truthfully, and Nina's book is very moving, not just for a German like me. It moved me to tears because of that. My mother left her American homeland 50 years ago to settle in Germany, and so she made the reverse trip. And I am not sure if I could have the same courage my mother had back then. And so I thought maybe then, sort of as a last reflection before we get to the nuts and bolts of what it takes to write a memoir, Juliette, maybe you can talk about how that is refracted in your Lebanese-American family and how that plays out in your work.
I mean, just hearing, both of us, we could get so stuck in the moment, but this idea that if you take the long view, right, and sort of how, how our country works and the opportunities we have, and I think I think my Lebanese background in a field of which, obviously there are issues around it. I'm Lebanese Christian and married to a Jewish lawyer and judge. He always says, can you narrow it down? His name's David Barron. And we have three kids being raised in the Jewish faith, but I did not convert. So we have a family like many of you. But this, in Homeland Security, it's always bad news. And there's like one thing that you get to do when I worked for Obama, and that is actually you get to bring new citizens in and you get to do the oath for them. And so I do tell the story about just this amazing moment where, my situ, who had come from Lebanon, and the challenges of being a Lebanese counterterrorism person trying to get security clearance because a lot of my mother's family was born in Beirut. Some of them were born in Cuba for reasons that I explain, and then came here And then this ability, this sort of long view of now bringing in, you know, so I, it's like somehow I had become, my family had become old guard, right? Like we were like, we're like the old Americans now compared to the new ones. So I tell that story, but I think also just a little bit about giving to your government and to your country was like just a big part of how I was raised, that America is something to be grateful for and to be optimistic about. And so I think if I can end with just one thing about this is, one of the things that make, people always ask me, are we safe? And I, if you've heard me around the 15th anniversary, I hate the question because of 9/11. I always say, are we safer? Because a country like ours will never be safe. And and what I try to get people to understand is that our vulnerability, we should embrace our vulnerabilities, right? That the movement of people and goods and ideas and all the things that we love about this country actually make us vulnerable. So we can reduce the risk to ourselves and our communities, but also embrace it. And people always ask me, are we safe or safer? And what makes America safer? And you know, separating the gun issue, there's two things. One is our oceans. You know, you can't drive from Boston to Damascus. You can, and so that protects us. But the other is something just not to forget in this time. And I'm sure I'm somewhat preaching to the converted here, but it's a huge theme of the last part of my book. Which is that the capacity of America to integrate, not perfectly, the other, whether it's the Irish here in Boston or the Mexicans in Los Angeles where I grew up or the Muslims in Dearborn, is really our most successful safety and security policy. That we just, we have our embracing of those who come here who are then committed to our to the country's safety and security, so much so that, you know, a daughter of Lebanese immigrants would end up at, you know, the heights of Homeland Security. And so just remembering that that, you know, in these times that actually the you know, it's not just the right thing to do or the progressive thing to do, but actually acceptance of the other has been an experiment in America that has been completely successful for us.
Well, it's something that when we have a never-ending election cycle, we might lose sight of the fact that empathy and understanding and vulnerability that both of these women show in their really terrific memoirs, which I commend to you, they show and they share. And I'm as a reader, I'm very grateful. I'm very happy for all of you in this room to purchase the books and have them signed across the hall once we finish this up. But there might be a story of this nature within you, and so you might have questions about how you structure a memoir and how you go back and relive your own life in a way that it can make it compelling to others. So my wonderful panel has said they're also very happy to talk about the nuts and bolts of memoir writing and thinking through one's own story. But truthfully, this is your opportunity. We have 20 minutes for questions to ask of these women anything that you have on your mind. And it, as you do, maybe introduce yourself, contextualize why you're here. Go ahead. Oh, sorry. Yep, we have something coming straight towards you.
Hi, my question is for Nina. Do I have to stand up? Okay. In the early 90s, I was very close with a bunch of young East Germans. And in addition to sort of recovering from the psychology of the psychological troubling, like the oppression that they had experienced, they also sort of experienced a big clash of cultures and understanding when they came to this country and witnessed capitalism. And one of them was reading a book called Alf Traum America, Nightmare America. And they were critical of a lot of things they saw, as well as embracing it and being grateful to be here. And you talked a little bit about how your family members, you gave them 10 or 15 years to just adjust, you said, before you asked them to talk about stuff. I'm wondering what that adjustment was like and what kinds of things they were happy to leave behind, if there were things that they missed, and if they had any criticism of the new system that they immersed themselves in by coming here.
What a great question. They were happy to leave the secret police behind, I can tell you that. Yes, it was an adjustment period, and not all of them felt that the best idea was for the wall to come down. I mean, there were There was a my cousin-in-law, so married to my cousin, who felt that had East Germany been allowed to continue, it would have been great. So, you know, and it was a wide range, but mostly, by and large, my family was thrilled to get out because they felt the oppression. They felt, they saw when Gorbachev came in, of course, all the countries around them. They heard through the grapevine that Poland was falling, that Hungary was falling, but they weren't falling. And so they were anxious to be a part of that. And when it happened, it was a huge adjustment for them. You know, this is an interesting part of how I structured the book, because I just remember in 1990, I was living in Garmisch, Germany, and one of my uncles from the East came over to visit me, and so this is just a year after the wall fell, and he had hardly been out. But we went to the supermarket, and this is my Uncle Mani in the book, and I told him, let's go to the supermarket and get some stuff to make for dinner, and we walked into the supermarket. I thought he was right behind me. I headed for the seafood section or whatever it was. I turned around, and Mani was not there. So I walked back, and he had barely made it in the entrance, and was standing in the produce aisle, staring at the stacks or whatever, you know, of apples. And he was, and I looked, and I realized three or four different kinds of apples. They all look great. They're in perfect condition. There's not a line waiting for them. And with my American perspective, I came back. I saw that he had tear-filled eyes, and I looked at him, and my American perspective was, I know, isn't it great? But that is not what he was thinking. I was completely off. And this made me really realize that I have a lot of work to do to try to figure out that East German mindset. And that was, he was overwhelmed. He didn't know if he could cope. I mean, just the apples alone, you know, was something that he just, it wasn't computing. He didn't know how to deal with that. And so that was an indication that, whoa, there was a lot of, you know, there were a lot of things they would need to learn to adjust to. That was just the beginning. To answer your question, yes, it really took them 10 or 15 years to adjust to freedom, to adjust to not looking over their shoulder, to realizing that the people in their midst are not necessarily informing on them. And that changes your life when you come into that, and you can imagine after 40 years of that, there's an adjustment.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hang on just a second.
Question for Nina. How does an East German meet and marry a Holocaust survivor?
Another great question. The long and the short of it is, so at the end of the war, my father came out of the Holocaust as the sole survivor of his family at 18 years old. Basically, he escaped from a death march in the end and caught up with the American tank company, who basically saved his life. So when he realized he did not have any family, he basically enlisted in the U.S. Army. And went to the United States, got quick naturalization. Actually, thanks to a lot of young soldiers taking tests for him, he didn't even speak English, so people took him under their wing and really pulled him through. He then went to OCS, became an officer, came back to Germany as a captain, as a U.S. Army captain, and my mother had escaped from East Germany and had struggled for the first few years, made enough money to study English, and had gotten a job with the U.S. Army in Heidelberg, and that is how they met. And just a quick story, and that is that she was working as a secretary, and he was in uniform and would walk by her desk and say, in perfect German, things like, good morning, Fräulein, or, you know, what is that you're working on, or what's in that big bag you have there? And she could not understand how this American captain had such fluent German. She just couldn't understand it. And eventually she asked him, and one thing led to another, and they married in Heidelberg.
Other questions? Yeah, here.
Yes, I'd be interested from each of you. The topic here is the personal to the political. And you each mentioned considering other forms to talk about political matters. And so I'd be interested in how you saw the memoir as being superior to other forms that you considered.
Did you have various drafts, Juliette, of one thing like this and one thing like that, and then
memoir went out? So I had the ideas before I had the form. And the idea was, seeing the book, it's sort of like stuff. Imagine you sort of built your life as the way we often do, around the notion that stuff happens. I use a not so nice word, but just rather than focusing on stopping all bad things from happening, right? What if we could think about our lives in a way in which, okay, I'm going to anticipate the jolt, what we call after the boom in Homeland Security, a pre-boom, which is prevention, after the boom. And then what would you invest in if you just sort of accepted that? And so, you know, just down the street, right? So a lot of the success of the Boston Marathon planning, I used to oversee the state side of the Boston Marathon planning, not during the attack, but that, you know, a lot of that response was where you would anticipate something bad would happen at the marathon. And that's the success of Boston Strong, right? Is that, like, to remind people that while three people tragically died there, you know, over 300 got sent to area hospitals, no one died, right? And in my world, that doesn't happen. You don't have 300. So I knew all these things, and then, you know, as I said, it was the email, you know, in terms of thinking, okay, well, there's a intimacy to Homeland Security that was not coming out on CNN or the way we talk about it or anything. And that also the skills that I was using at work were very familiar or you know, parallel to the skills that I was learning as a new mother, including some of the mistakes. So I thought I could tell the story of each chapter is a sort of disaster or a moment. You know, my kids, Cecilia was born 6 weeks before 9/11. Leah was born 2 days after we went to war in Iraq, and Jeremiah was born as the levees broke in 2005. So you want to talk about my career, and, you know, they're not related, but something was happening. So, and then just on the drafts issue, but I was not good at it. Like, so I sent a draft. I lost, one of my editors went to another publishing house. So I had a new editor than the one who had bought it at Simon & Schuster. And she was a woman, so maybe that helped a little bit. So she read a draft that I thought I was done with. And I remember the email back to me. I was sitting on a beach in Puerto Rico, and it said, new editor equals need new book. You can imagine when you finish a manuscript to hear that. And what she said was, this is a memoir, so tell me stories about yourself. I thought I was disclosing it. And so it was just that more personal process of having to sort of unearth, you know, and unpeel yourself so that I'm much more present in this book than in the first drafts. So that took a year. I mean, that was, and my husband is much more private than me. He's a judge and doesn't. So then he got, he did get editorial discretion. I just didn't want to put him out there in a way. So it ended up, he basically took himself out of the book. So I seem much more Wonder Woman than I am. Like, there is actually a helpful partner in this. And so at some stage in the book, I had to write, David appears more in this book than he wants and less than he should. Just to make it clear that in my own telling, I didn't want to cause him stress because he just doesn't feel comfortable with that role.
Mm. Yeah, and in my case, you know, certainly this book could be looked at as a history book. I mean, it's written that way in that I tell the story, the entire story, of East, West Germany, and then the bigger picture Cold War story. So this, the whole, you know, Soviet-American superpower struggle for dominance in the space race and the nuclear arms race and the conflicts that raged around the world during the Cold War. So, I mean, you learn all of that. So if you didn't know that before and you're just learning about the Cold War, you'll read all about it in the book. And then within that is this the story of my family that's forcibly separated for 40 years, never knowing if they'll see each other again. But in terms of the, you know, the memoir part of it, I definitely went back and forth. I thought this could be a, you know, really a history, just kind of you know, sort of work that a little bit more, and then it went to this sort of narrative nonfiction, which it's, I still think it could be seen as a narrative nonfiction. But then when I put myself into the picture and a lot of other family members, it just sort of naturally became a memoir.
I have plenty more questions to ask, but this is really your time. Yeah.
Germany and East Germany, is the East-West divide emotionally still kind of there, or in terms of politics, or?
Great question. Yeah, I mean, yes, absolutely. And now it's been made interesting because you have all the refugees coming in. I think Germany took in 1 million refugees last year, and so that has now created sort of a different dynamic and. But certainly with the East and the West, you know, a lot of the young people from the East went to the West to get jobs. A lot of the older people and families are still in the East. But yes, there's still a division. It's getting better, and I think it depends on where you are in East Germany. But there still sort of is a, in the beginning was there obviously there's this mindset about the West thinkers and the East thinkers, but I do think it's moving forward, it's progressing, and it's just a matter of time.
I'll just add to that of course, if you have two countries which deal with their own histories and their own involvement, if you will, in World War II in completely different ways, where you had the West, you know, the responsibility for the Holocaust and really what was ultimately, you know, the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century is something that, as somebody who went to German schools all of her life, and you know, that became a personal responsibility of mine to be as informed about the misdeeds of my country and my countrymen. That is a critical responsibility that was given, passed on to every German school child after the war. But that is really a hallmark of the West. In the East, that sort of work on history and responsibility was not done and was pushed away for a very long time in an effort then to mold this new Germany. So part of that sort of 50 years of work on what it meant to be West German was not the kind of identity work that was being done in the East. So obviously now we're 26 years after the fall of the wall. That's one full generation, of people who are far younger than I am now. And it's still, that's work. And to the question that came up earlier, we did have a backlash in Germany, people who were very nostalgic for the East. And if you look at some of the election results now, specifically in Eastern states, we have a big election coming up in Germany in 2017. You're seeing some backlash, and the backlash, the way that it manifests itself in local elections, is to say, it's getting there, but we're not all there yet. So that's definitely true. Yeah, go ahead.
Hello, thank you so much. First of all, I came in a little late, so you may have spoken to the question I have, but maybe not. The question is about voice, because you're speaking from your own personal perspective. You're also bringing in history, political perspectives, perhaps kind of socioeconomic perspectives. So could you just talk a little bit about how you play or how you approached making that flow or hang together in whatever way you did?
Yeah, that's good. You know, can you tackle that first?
That was a very difficult thing for me. Yeah. In fact, when I first queried my agent, who happens to be here, she came back with, I love it, but you really have to ground your voice. You have to find your voice. And mm-hmm. I said, what is voice? Yeah. So it was pretty much, starting from the ground up. And, for me, I just had to play with it and look at the stories, look at the stories of the people, how it affected me, how I felt, my perspective, and how I felt about what was being written. And I just, it wasn't forced. I mean, after a while, certainly in the beginning, it was very, informational and directive. And it was just no voice whatsoever. But I think it just came with time and sinking into the story and listening to the stories and seeing how he's going to weave it. It just sort of came naturally after that for me.
This is both of our first sort of mainstream books, so it's interesting to hear you had the same struggles. So just two things just to pick up. So one is my worry with voice was I haven't served in the military. I'm not a first responder. You know, I wanted to be very... I needed to be careful, but I wanted to make it clear, look, you know, I've been in policy positions in this weird world, but the sacrifices compared to, you know, the people who are actually out there in the field. So I really struggled with that and sort of making sure that while it was my voice, I needed to ground it in, you know, the non-hero aspects of it, right? So I may have a job in which bad things are happening and I basically manage public safety agencies, but I'm not a first responder or a military. I think the other thing for me on sort of how you find your voice is that, as I said, I'm optimistic, I like humor, and, you know, I swear all the time. I wanted that voice to come out. There was a very fine line, though, and sometimes my editor would sort of cut things out, like between that and this is for professional woman in the room, you know, the sort of, oh my God, you know, the sort of Private Benjamin type of thing, you know? And so I needed to really balance that I was authoritative, and that's hard for professional women, especially in a field that is so serious, but that humor is part of my life. And so that was the challenge in terms of voice. And sometimes I may have fallen on the other side and needed to bring it back to, I'm an expert, I need to tell this story. Yeah. So those were my challenges.
So we have about a minute and a half left with these incredible women. So I will let you have one last question if you have something at the tip of your tongue before we commend to you. Again, they're signing just across the hall. So that last question goes to you.
Julie, I just want to say I love you on Boston Public Radio.
Thank you. I can't hear you.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Questions for both of you. Did you get any, not backlash, but any feedback from your family members with respect to their portrayals in both your books?
Any portrayals in the book?
Yes. Did your family members, were they happy with how their story was told?
Yeah, they were very happy because really, for me, the story is, you know, it's tough stories, but it's grounded in love and this core of this family that's working hard to stay together despite the odds. So I think it was very important for me to do justice to the story, to really get their story right, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But in the end, you know, it was very important to them that history be told as it was, you know, tell it like it was, and I found that the core was unity in the family anyway, so they were very pleased with that as well. So, no, I did not have any problem with that.
Were your children happy with the fact that she revealed their birth weights?
So as I said, my husband, it wasn't happy or unhappy. My marriage will outlast any book, and I needed to respect his sense. So looking at the book now, I sort of wish, because he's such a wonderful person and such a part of this whole thing that I was describing, but that was, and I didn't fight it. I mean, at some stages he was being ridiculous and I was like, I can mention your name, but the kids for me, the kids were, so this is a 10-year period where, you know, now my daughter's 15. My daughter really appears a lot less in the book than the boys as a character, and part of it, anyone who has a teenage girl, she just didn't want it. She goes up to her room and, you know, she's a teenage girl. And so I let them all read and sort of focus in on parts that were about them and molded it. And just, but the bigger, larger Lebanese family, it wasn't that they opposed it. Like, they just didn't get it. Like, you know, to them, they were part of that Lebanese generation that said, we're Christians. So these were like this was the voluntary wave before the Civil War. And it was just like, why would you go back to the homeland? Like, we're American. Like, you know, and I'll end with this. So my Arab American, every time I got an appointment in state government or federal government, it always mentioned Arab American, even though I didn't identify that way. And so because it's a unique thing, and my situ, my Lebanese grandmother, who, you know, came here, the kids did not learn Arabic, you are American, whatever, the New York Times headline when I got a position, a federal position, said Arab American gets appointed to the National Commission on Terrorism. It was controversial at the time. And she calls me and she says, "You call the New York Times and you tell them you're not Arab American, you're Lebanese American." Which, like, you know, only if you're Arab do you know that that's a big distinction. But so in a way, it wasn't that they wanted the story to be told. They just thought, you know, we're American. Like, what's that about? So, which is probably a success story.
Well, the one thing that ties these two extraordinary stories together, in looking into the future, both of these women have children, and we now have plenty of sociological evidence that what makes kids most resilient and most able to adapt and to bounce back is a strong anchoring in their own family stories, to know that grandfather lost a leg in the war and still here he is spinning his lore. And both of these books do this in different ways and in beautiful ways. So in that sense, I think both of them have a very optimistic outlook for the future. To ground that in the context of an American discussion, I find that quintessentially American and hence have chosen to make my life here where my parents make their life in Germany. I want to thank all of you for being here, for engaging with us. Again, these women are here to sign their lives away for the books that I highly commend to you. I want to thank Maisie Houghton for sponsoring this lovely event. Have a wonderful afternoon.